Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, expanding economic and political opportunity for Californians who are working but struggling with poverty. The California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendowed.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
Today on Valley Edition, there's a proposed new route for high-speed rail through the city of Bakersfield. The city says it's a much better and less intrusive route than the old plan, but critics say the new location for the high-speed rail station leaves a lot to be desired. We'll look at the pluses and minuses of both sides. We'll also talk with folk singer John McCutcheon about his new CD and his tour that brings him to Fresno on Thursday night. But we begin with a look at air quality. If you were in the valley over the holidays, the recent rain probably has you breathing a sigh of relief, not just because it's brought much-needed rain and snow, but also because it's the first time in weeks you can safely breathe. FM89's Kerry Klein looks back at one of the most severe stretches of smoggy air in decades.
When James Collins isn't studying social work at Fresno State, he drives for the rideshare company Lyft. He sees a lot of open sky and bright sun. Starting in late December, though, he says the sky looked different.
Sometimes the sun would pop through in the evenings. Some days, though, it wouldn't. It would just stay hazy and foggy or smoggy.
Beginning December 21st, concentrations of particulate matter, or microscopic particles in the air, began to climb. Collins noticed his body responding. He started wheezing. Then,
throughout the day, I would have a lot of small headaches. And then after, I kind of looked up a little bit about the weather and even trying to understand why it was hazy. That had me concerned. That kind of raised eyebrows.
Many health outcomes were worse. Dr. Vipul Jain is a pulmonologist at Community Regional Medical Center in downtown Fresno. He said for a few weeks, he observed an uptick in respiratory flare-ups in urgent care in the emergency room.
Patients will describe that as wheezing, chest tightness, cough. You know, if it's just allergic, you know, they're outside of the lungs, they may get itchy eyes, sore throat, those kind of symptoms.
Many other health centers in the valley confirmed the same trend beyond the typical spikes in seasonal flu. It's undisputed. From late December until last week, the valley's air quality was atrocious. By some measures, it was the worst stretch of unhealthy air in almost 20 years. That pollution is directly correlated to respiratory issues and other short and long-term health problems. What is disputed, however, is what the sources of that pollution were and what can be done about them. To a large extent, the region's poor air quality is a consequence of geography and weather. Mountain ranges block airflow on three sides, and wintertime weather patterns trap pollution low to the ground. Without rain, strong wind, or release of atmospheric pressure, the smog stagnates and hangs in place, which is why Deputy Air Pollution Control Officer Samir Sheikh of the Valley Air District was so glad to see last week's storm system.
There's a sense of relief when we see that in the forecast. There's a sense of optimism that those conditions will help bring some much-needed assistance in helping us clear out some of what's been trapped here in the valley for these last couple of weeks.
Indeed, last Wednesday's rainfall ended nearly 2 weeks of stifling smog. In Bakersfield, it was the longest period of unhealthy levels of particulate matter since 1999, though many winters during the recent drought had more unhealthy days than this season has so far. As for the source of those pollutants, the Air District holds that emissions are lower than they've ever been, and that it was Southern California's recent wildfires that drove particle pollution up to dangerously high levels.
We know that the fires have been a huge issue. Those emissions don't go anywhere when you have this high pressure that traps it to the ground.
State data do show drastic reductions in emissions over the last 15 years for both particulate matter and its precursor pollutants like nitrous oxides. But UC Davis air quality researcher Chris Kappa says satellite imagery suggests smoke from the most recent fires blew mostly away from the valley. The biggest culprits in this recent episode, he says, were the usual ones: vehicle emissions, agricultural processes, and residential wood burning, despite the Air District's burn restrictions.
It is very likely that the check before you burn has reduced emissions, but it hasn't eliminated them.
And for most of the smoggy time span, burning wasn't fully banned, but was allowed on registered devices, which burn more cleanly than conventional fireplaces. Although the Air District has shifted its general focus toward reducing vehicle emissions, Dolores Barajas-Weller of the Central Valley Air Quality Coalition would like to see tighter burning restrictions. She says allowing it on clean air days serves only to drive pollution levels back up, even with registered devices, which still emit more than not burning at all.
The enforcement of that program also can be slightly weak in that, you know, we hear from a lot of community members saying that, you know, people burn in their neighborhood regardless of, you know, the check before you burn status.
As for James Collins, he wishes air quality information were easier to find. For example, if it were integrated into the weather apps he checks on his smartphone.
If I have to work harder than the mom and dads and families and stuff, they're not going to bother to look at that kind of information. And I just wish it was more streamlined and accessible.
He also urges Valley residents to consider ride sharing and taking public transportation. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
And joining us now live in our studio to continue the conversation, not just about the air, but the weather overall as we enter 2018, we have with us in our studio Sean Boyd, local meteorologist and professor at Fresno State. Sean, welcome.
Welcome. Good to be here.
Sean, before we get into this most recent precipitation event that's still underway, which we are so happy to see a very dry end of 2017, I want to go back to this air quality thing and that stretch that we had for a couple of weeks that ended last year and began this year.
Right.
From a meteorological perspective, how unique was that stretch that we had?
It was extreme. I concur with the UC Davis researcher who said rightfully, scientifically so, that when the Thomas Fire was going on and the other fires are going on in Santa Barbara and Ventura counties, most of that smoke was blown offshore by winds coming out of the east, which are Santa Ana winds. Between about December 24th and about January 4th, when we had persistent high pressure aloft and a very strong temperature inversion over the valley, there was very little wind on the surface or primarily aloft to transport smoke from those fires to the San Joaquin Valley. It would have had to been a pretty brisk southerly wind aloft to bring that smoke here, and that was not happening at the time. So the usual culprits were the culprits, I believe, which were agricultural pollution, vehicles, and primarily simply people burning wood when they're not supposed to burn wood in their fireplaces. Look, people have been burning wood ever since we were able to control fire, but the bottom line is that in a developed nation, in most places in the U.S., burning wood for heat and for cooking is an ancient practice. And I fail to understand why it is that people don't care about their neighbors. I mean, I talk to, I'm not naming names, I communicate with a former Fresno Bee reporter who talked to one of his neighbors who was burning wood on a no-burn day, and the neighbor basically said, look, the government's taken so much away from us, they're not taking that away from me. I'm putting a log in my fireplace. And unfortunately, this is a problem, you know. I'm very thankful for the rain for a number of reasons, including but not limited to cleaning the air up finally so we can breathe again for a few days.
And again, a confluence of factors there coming together and making a very dangerous situation for Valley residents with the air quality. Thankfully, that is behind us right now, at least for the present. Let's talk about what's happening right now in the Valley. And this is really the first big storm of this winter that we have seen, certainly in the central San Joaquin Valley. The South Valley just got it overnight, 4 a.m. to 7 a.m., had a big downpour there in Kern County.
Yes.
So put in this storm into context so far for us, Sean.
All right, sure will. So I had to get the stats revised from when I did my research about 36 hours ago initially, because things have changed. It's a moving target. So if we go to 4 o'clock this morning, that's kind of the cutoff. Fresno had about 4/10 of an inch of rain for the storm, which brings us to about 9/10 for the water year to date. That's from October 1st to the present.
That's rather dismal sounding.
Yeah, which is only 22% of average for the water year to date. Up till 4 a.m., Bakersfield only had, 600s for the storm. At 1,300s for the entire rainfall or water year so far since October 1. Normally it's 2.25. So they were at 5% of average for the water year as of 4 a.m. Now that's changed in the last few hours because the cold front went through Kern County and Meadowsfield did report heavy rain. Similarly, for the season to date to 4 a.m., excuse me, I'm going to revise my statement. For the water year to date since October 1st, Hanford is only at 28% of average. Madera is only at 20% of average. Now, Merced is at 39% of average. And you're wondering, well, gee, why has Merced got this bump up? That's because they reaped the benefits of storms that hit the northern third of the state in November, which were quite wet. They were just on the southern edge of that. So those are the stats to date with respect to the water year to date from October 1st to the present. You know, the rain is welcome. In California, anytime it rains, it snows. It's a gift. But one of the problems with the West, and one of the really most interesting books I've read about this topic lately, is actually a book called The West Without Water, which I'm going to pull out of my case so that I can read the author's names. The West Without Water by B. Lynn Ingram and Francis Mulliman Rome. I think they're both UC Berkeley scientists. Is that when we have rain and snow in the West in our wet season, that rain and snow primarily comes due to a few to several major events. If we don't get those major events during the time we're supposed to get them, then the D word starts to creep back into our vocabulary. So yes, this is the first major storm for Central and Southern California for the 2017-2018 water year.
So speaking of the D word, people have been mentioning that for the last couple of months as we saw storms pass us by, that being drought. Where do we stand right now in our storage for this area, because water storage being such a big concern in our reservoirs?
It's a very good question. Now, these stats are as of Sunday. And no doubt the stats have come up a little bit since the storm began. It takes a little while. There's some lag time between when the precipitation falls in the watersheds and goes into the reservoirs, of course. But, for instance, Pine Flat right now is at 50% of capacity, but at 119% based on history for this date. So that clearly shows carryover from our excessively wet year, the 2016-2017 winter. Don Pedro is at 81% of capacity. That's 122% of average for history to date. And let's see, I've got Millerton, 68% of capacity now, but it's 125% of historic storage for this date. So you can see there's carryover on surface water, which, of course, by any measure is a good thing.
How much of that is due to management decisions versus just the sheer amount that was in the system from last year?
Well, it's a combination of both. I couldn't answer or address management decisions. I'm sure that some of the most nervous people in California are the people who manage those dams. I wouldn't want to be one of them. They probably have one of the most high-pressure jobs you can get anywhere in California. Now, the anomaly is Oroville, by the way, which is only at 35% of capacity and 56% of historic storage to date. And that primarily is because of the repair on the spillway that's still going on.
And that is significant, though, because Oroville being the largest reservoir in the State Water Project, which supplies Kern County and Southern California with much-needed water through that
system. It's a big deal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So before we get into the long-term outlook, I want to go back a little bit, back to when it was very dry at the end of last year, November, December, in this part of California.
We spoke a week and 6 days ago today on this same show.
Exactly. And things did not look good at that point.
But they were just beginning to change.
Exactly. We had this return earlier, a few weeks ago, of the ridiculously resilient ridge, as some people call it, this block of high pressure that was out there. Funneling storms away from us and then also bringing some of that cold weather to the East Coast and the Mid-Atlantic states and things like that. We have seen that in recent years before. In fact, 2017 ended much like a few years ago. I think it was 2013, one of those drought years. Can you compare what we were seeing there with maybe those years in the drought?
Well, the pattern in late November through all of December was strikingly reminiscent of the 2013-2014 winter, the 2014-2015 winter, when, in fact, the triple R, and I believe the researchers that were at Stanford coined this term, a guy named Swain and a guy named Diffenbach, the ridiculously resilient ridge. It was there, perhaps not as strong as it was during those winters, but it had the capability of weakening approaching storms or splitting the energy from storms, driving some of the energy north into British Columbia, Washington State, some of the energy south where it would dissipate. And this is actually quite quite analogous to the La Nina pattern, which we see. And that's, of course, the next question you're probably going to ask me is, what's the status of La Nina? Well,
you read my mind, Sean.
Yeah. Well, to refresh everybody's memory, neither El Nino nor La Nina are storms. They are not storms. It's part of a bigger seesaw pattern of sea surface temperatures in the equatorial Pacific Ocean, stretching from Peru to Indonesia, called ENSO, El Nino Southern Oscillation. Normally, the water off the coast of Peru is cold, kind of like it is here in California. If that water gets much colder than average, which it is now, we are in then a La Nina phase. And that is the best guess of the Climate Prediction Center now, that we are in a La Nina phase and that the predictions are we'll stay in a La Nina phase through northern hemispheric winter and into early northern hemispheric spring. Typically, that means that central and southern California remain on the dry side as far as our precipitation accumulation in a typical winter under these conditions. That's not always the case. For instance, doing a little research, and I attribute this to some extent to Jan Knoll of Golden Gate Weather Services, it's interesting to note that even though historically La Nina winters mean drier than average conditions for central and southern California, there were three La Ninas in the past 20 years which were above average, including 2005-2006, 2010-2011, which was the seventh wettest season in Fresno history, and 2016-2017, which was the eighth wettest season in Fresno history. So it doesn't always go to show that just because there's a La Nina that it is going to be dry. But statistically speaking, in the last 70 years, that has been the case.
Now, does this go back to what you were talking about earlier with the water in the West, or the West without water, where the fact that so much of our precipitation comes from just a handful of events?
Yes.
It's really just the luck of the draw if you happen to wind up in the right path?
Yes, that's right.
And the Pineapple Express kind of phenomenon?
Yeah, exactly. Atmospheric rivers, as they're called. And that's a term that is used, you know, quite a lot. Atmospheric river is essentially defined as a highly, a greater than average amount of water vapor in the upper atmosphere, which targets a particular area for at least 24 hours. And so there are some that are saying our current system or series of systems is part of an atmospheric river. But what Ingram and Malibu-Rome discussed in their book is the paleoclimatological evidence, meaning looking at the sediments in old lakes in the West. And when they say the West, they're basically mean from the Rockies westward to the Pacific, that strongly suggests that there have been periods of droughts called mega droughts, which have lasted for decades in parts of the West, long before there were tens of millions of people living the way they live. We're talking about, you know, indigenous societies that, you know, basically lived off the land and so on. And they were adversely affected. They talk about the people in Chaco Canyon who may have their civilization may have been destroyed because of a mega drought of that sort. So we've got all these people now, and everybody's got their straw into sources like the Delta or the Colorado River. And you have to ask these serious questions about, in the very long term, how sustainable is this?
Now, going back to this idea of the ridiculously resilient ridge, there's some discussion, and reading Daniel Swain, who's the Weather West a meteorologist, mm-hmm. Who's now at UCLA and coined that term, he did not go so far as to say this is a result of climate change, but he did raise the question as to, is there a possible connection, and is there some more research that we need to do to try to determine what's going on up in the Arctic and with this ridiculously resilient ridge of high pressure. What do you, what have you read on that particular issue? Is there any link from what you know?
It is difficult, if not impossible, to take one event and link it to climate change. Swain's right about that. But what climate change does do is it exacerbates existing patterns and amplifies them. It makes them more extreme. The former head of NASA, I believe, Hansen is his last name. I can't remember his first name off the top of my head. But he looks at it this way. If you take extremes in weather events around the world and compare the number of extremes and the intensity of those extremes to the 1951 to 1980 averages for extreme weather, we're finding that the number of extremes and the extremity of those extremes has increased by about 3 standard deviations to the right of the top of that bell curve, which are the 1951 to 1980 averages for extremes. So while you cannot say, oh, Harvey was because of climate change, oh, Irma was because of climate change, or oh, our drought was because of climate change, when you add it up in the aggregate, human-induced climate change, because of the release of greenhouse gases, can exacerbate existing patterns and make them more extreme. That much we can say with confidence.
So as we're running out of time here, I want to get to the big question moving ahead of what is moving ahead. Obviously, it's a cone of probability with all the different models that are out there, and it changes very quickly as those models are run every day or less than that. Mm-hmm. What are you seeing right now in the immediate future, and then maybe if you go as far as you want into the longer-term opportunities for precip here in the Valley?
Well, I guess this is kind of where human geography has a nexus with physical geography, because on the human side of things, I suppose we should expect the worst but hope for the best. If the combination of this being a weak to moderate La Nina, plus adding into it something we don't have time to talk about, the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, which is also in a slight negative phase, meaning that waters are colder than average, those two in combination typically spell dry conditions during the wet season for Central and Southern California. That would be the best projection going forward for the next 3 months. But, you know, anything can happen. Look what happened this time last year when things turned around very quickly and with tremendous results. And, of course, the bad side of this is we've had some tremendous fires, the Thomas Fire being the largest fire in modern California history. And now we have debris flows between Santa Barbara and Ventura, which have closed that highway. So there are consequences. Nonetheless, we have to take the bad with the good, because California needs every drop from the sky it can get.
And then the short term coming up here over the next few days, should we expect any more storms, or are we going to be drying out?
Computer models strongly suggest there seems to be unanimity right now that after this storm passes through here in the next 24 to 30 hours, that we'll go back to a ridge of high pressure, which will be rather stable, meaning not moving very much. And that will mean mountains will start to warm up and the valley will be prone to night and morning fog now that we've had some soil moisture and probably no major storms for at least a week. There is a hint of something perhaps in about a week and a half. We'll just have to wait and see.
We will see. And the return of that sometimes elusive valley fog.
Yes.
Some people will await that eagerly, but I know others will be dreading that occurrence.
I would say watch for that on Thursday morning especially.
All right. Sean Boyd, meteorologist and geography professor at Fresno State, joining us today talking about the weather here on Valley Edition. Sean, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
This is Valley Edition, and stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment and find out about the pluses and minuses of a new route for high-speed rail through Bakersfield and a new site for the city's high-speed rail station. It's all coming up after this. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. If the leaders of California's high-speed rail authority are to be believed, by 2029, Bakersfield residents will be able to hop on a bullet train bound for LA's Union Station or San Francisco's Transbay Terminal. That's if all goes according to plan, for a project that still doesn't have enough funding to finish the job. But regardless of the pace of construction, there's still a lot of decisions that the state needs to make in the next 11 years in order to prepare. things like what route the train will take and where stations should be located. In Bakersfield, both of those issues are still up in the air. Should the station be located near the current Amtrak station in the heart of downtown on Truxton, or should it be well to the north near F Street and Golden State? That's the issue at hand this month, as the Rail Authority has issued its study of a new route that aims to reduce the impacts to the community. Some say it's a good thing, as it displaces fewer businesses and actually costs less, but others say it's a missed opportunity and puts the station in the wrong location. The issue was seemingly settled back in 2014 when the Rail Authority adopted its current environmental plan, routing the tracks along the Burlington Northern Santa Fe rail line from Shafter into Bakersfield and right through downtown, skirting past Mercy Hospital, Bakersfield High, and the Convention Center. But as Bakersfield City Manager Alan Tandy says, that route caused big problems for the city, and they sued.
It took out the city's courtyard. It's the site from which we provide all our field services throughout the community to maintain the streets, the parks, pick up the garbage, our motor vehicle maintenance fleet, among others. Took out all of the parking for our arena and convention center, and it took out our police maintenance garage, which is essentially public service. Took out a brand new amenity we call Mill Creek, which had brand newly constructed affordable housing beside it. And we weren't the only one to file a lawsuit under CEQA at that time. The Kern County did, and Dignity Health did, due to damage to the downtown hospital.
And those lawsuits ultimately helped kick off something of a Plan B for the rail line's route through Bakersfield, something that's now known as the locally generated alternative.
The authority met with us in out-of-court settlement discussions, and we agreed that if they would study the alignment along the Union Pacific tracks, which our planning staff came up with, and go through a formal environmental review process of that as a possible alternate alignment, we would drop the litigation.
And that's what's being studied right now in a plan that's currently out for public comment. The new plan would put the station at F and Golden State and bypass the heart of downtown Bakersfield, skirting on the edge of Old Town Kern. City Manager Tandy says it has a lot of advantages from his perspective.
The alignment, unlike the hybrid, is fully buffered by the existing railroad tracks on one side. Instead of 500 parcels and 170 residential, it's approximately 105 parcels and virtually no residential, almost all industrial property. The alignment is straighter, lower in elevation, allows the train to go faster, costs less, and impacts far, far fewer properties. So it is superior in virtually every way, if you talk about engineering-related issues.
But what some might see as a superior engineering solution, others say is a flawed plan from a functional perspective. Enter transportation planner Adam Cohen of Bakersfield, one of the new alignment's stiffest critics.
Whenever we put in a infrastructure project of this magnitude through the heart of any city, we are going to be going through neighborhoods. Both alignments are going to do that. But the question that I would ask is, if we're going to have similar challenges with both, why not then place it at the heart of downtown? Why not place it, is at Amtrak for a multimodal connector?
He says the location on F Street is too far away from the heart of downtown Bakersfield and is a missed opportunity for both development and for a multimodal transportation hub.
The city wants to place the station at the very north end of Bakersfield on the city border. So the city has no zoning control at all when they cross over the other side of the river. You can't develop into the river, and approximately 23% of the one-mile radius around the F Street station is within the Kern riverbed.
And he says while the new alignment wouldn't tear down the historic structures of Old Town Kern, it would place a giant viaduct looming over them.
It also creates about a 70-foot-tall viaduct, an elevated rail structure, which, you know, I'm sure the listeners have seen under construction in Fresno, over Sumner Street, which is the center of Old Town Kern. So it really bisects the Old Town Kern neighborhood and jeopardizes the Pyrenees Cafe and the Noriega Hotel and all these establishments that are going to be right below these railroad tracks.
He says the original plan to put the high-speed rail station downtown next to the existing train station is the one that makes the most sense.
Well, what the Truxton site has is it has an intermodal connection with Amtrak. You know, multimodality is recognized as a industry best practice. We are building a Transbay terminal in San Francisco. We have a multimodal hub at Dearborn Station in San Jose, a multimodal station in Union Station in Los Angeles, also in Anaheim. So Bakersfield's Truxton Station is this multimodal hub where people can transfer from the bus to Amtrak to high-speed rail, and all these services can come together because we know that when we place these services together, there's a network effect.
Of course, the city disagrees with Cohen's criticism. Alan Tandy points out that Bakersfield just recently completed a new planning process to guide downtown's revitalization and future growth and orient it towards the station, which he says provides more development potential at the F Street site.
If the theoretical dream is ever realized, it would fundamentally change traffic in and out of Bakersfield. So there would need to be growth around it, commercial growth, residential growth, hotels, in order to have a location where there is capacity for that kind of growth. It needs to be less than fully built out and developed, which is exactly the location selected on F Street. It has a variety of properties in and around it that are suitable for retrofit, for redevelopment, for upgrading.
He says by comparison, the site on Truxton is already built out and doesn't offer those same possibilities. The city council has already weighed in and endorsed the new F Street site. Now it's up to the High Speed Rail Authority to do so. They're accepting comments through next week from the public. You can find a link on our website at kvpr.org. Of course, there's one last irony to this development. As of early 2018, the Rail Authority still doesn't have the money to build the line into Bakersfield, meaning all of this planning might be for naught. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Joe Moore. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Nowhere in California has the expansion of Medi-Cal been more significant than in the San Joaquin Valley. Most counties in the region have roughly half of their total population eligible for the program. Of course, getting access to care isn't always so simple. And in mid-2017, the problem got even worse for residents in the northern part of our listening area, as one group of clinics there closed down after months of turmoil and bankruptcy proceedings. Reporter Monica Velez of the Merced Sun-Star has been covering the issue for the past year as part of a project with the USC Annenberg California Health Journalism Fellowship. She joins us now. Monica, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So what was the Horizon Clinic, before we talk about what happened? Who did they serve and where were they? What was this operation?
Yeah, so Horizons Unlimited Healthcare, they have 8 clinics throughout Merced, Stanislaus, Madera, and Mariposa counties. And in the legal documents, it states that they serve thousands of patients, 80% which were on Medi-Cal.
So this was in operation for some time in the North Valley, but something earlier this year started to happen there. How did this begin?
So the legal battle surrounding Horizons surfaced in March, when its former CEO, Sandra Haar, who was with them since 2004, since the opening, she was fired and sued. In a lawsuit through the Merced County Superior Court, it states she was accused of mishandling finances and using the clinic's money so her and her family could profit.
So that's where things began, and that ultimately started to affect patient care. How did this play out in that sense? I understand there were services that began disappearing.
Yeah, so the clinic was involved in legal battles, not only with the CEO, but also board members. And after that, the clinics went through a lot of proceedings, and they eventually filed for bankruptcy in May. And shortly after May, I started talking to different patients, and they were telling me that their appointments were being canceled or rescheduled, and they weren't able to have a reason why. Nobody was telling them. So the clinics kind of kept them in the dark. Staff was telling patients that they were letting go of staff. Some people were even told to go see other doctors. So patients were struggling to find places to go, not sure why they couldn't continue going to Horizons. Ultimately, the clinic closures, which happened in August, after all of the clinics closed, is pretty much when everybody needed to find another provider.
And how did that work out for those patients? As you mentioned in your coverage in the Sun Star, about half of the county in Merced County is relying on Medi-Cal. There are already challenges to finding care in this part of the state for people who are on that program. How difficult was it for patients who had relied on Horizons to get care?
Well, so roughly 51% of people in Merced County are on Medi-Cal. So, of course, this kind of created another layer for patients where that was their primary care home, where they went for care in general. So a lot of patients had to seek to other clinics around. And officials at the Livingston Community Health Clinics that are in Merced County and Stanislaus County, they said that their patient size doubled right when the closure happened in August. So for them, for patients there, it was getting even harder to find a doctor when they needed one.
What happened to the people who worked at these clinics, the various medical professionals? You have physicians that were also there. What happened to all of those people? Did they just vanish and go into other communities, or are they still in the valley?
Yeah, so that's something else that's been pretty unclear. In the legal documents, it states that not a lot of the physicians got paid the times that they were there, and they were owed some money. And so right now, it's still some ongoing reporting that I've been doing, and it's still unclear whether what's happening to all the people who work there or if they're going to get paid the wages they were owed.
So there's also an issue, as I understand from your reporting, about medical records, people having access to their data and their medical history. How does the closure of a set of clinics like Horizons, how does that affect people who are trying to get access to their medical history?
Yeah, so in one of the stories I wrote, a woman from Chowchilla, she and her two daughters, they were patients at Horizons, and they did their dental work there, and both of her daughters had braces, and she said no other orthodontist wanted, you know, to touch the braces because they didn't have the medical records they needed, and it was a struggle for her to get the medical records she needed from Horizons. That also was still a little bit unclear as to why. And so for her, you know, her family was impacted by the loss of Horizons for sure. And there was a lot of similar stories to hers as well.
You mentioned that a lot of the story is kind of murky, in that there's elements of, you know, many people in a case like this sometimes don't want to talk. You talk to a lot of patients and people who are on the receiving end of care at Horizons. What did they tell you? People like the family that you just talked about. What did you hear from them?
Yeah, so most people, you know, reported in the story say a lot of them, there was just a lot of confusion. You know, people didn't understand why they weren't able to go there. A lot of people just wanted an answer, a reason as to why. And that was very unclear. You know, they weren't able to get that answer. And a lot of them were in the middle of having procedures done. And it kind of sent them on a whirlwind where they didn't really know where to go now, because they're all familiar with how difficult it is to get a doctor in the valley. And so this just added another layer to that.
Again, we'll be following that in the Merced Sun Star. Reporter Monica Velez here with us today, talking about the collapse of a network of clinics serving residents in the northern part of our listening area in Merced and Stanislaus counties, Horizons Healthcare. This is part of a reporting fellowship with the USC Annenberg, California Health Journalism Fellowship. And Monica joins us today talking about the impact to people, especially those on Medi-Cal in the Valley. Monica, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It is a perfect night.
You're listening to Valley Edition. The sounds we hear there are from the new CD by folk singer and instrumentalist John McCutcheon. He's coming to Fresno on Thursday night for a performance at the Unitarian Universalist Church, and he joins us now. John, welcome.
Thanks. It's nice to be here, even virtually.
Exactly.
Especially, can't wait to get there on Thursday.
Especially in 2018 now. It's good to be going and moving forward, and you're moving forward as you have a new CD coming out next month called Ghost Light, your 39th of your career. I imagine you'll be playing some selections from that as well as some old favorites. Let's start out with the new recording. What prompted the inspiration for this record?
This was a totally accidental recording. I really didn't intend to do this album. I released an album last year called Trolling for Dreams. And it was a particularly strong album, and I was getting great reviews and a lot of best of lists. And I really enjoyed performing the songs from it. And next year was going to be I was going to do an album this year in preparation for next year, because next year would have been Pete Seeger's 100th anniversary. And I was going to do an all Pete Seeger album. But then over Memorial Day weekend, I sat down and this line came to me, Billy didn't come home last night. And I don't know where it came from. I didn't know who Billy was. I didn't know what happened to him. But I've been doing this long enough that I was all too willing to follow the muse. And every day I had something happen to me. And 25 days and 30 new songs later, I thought, now what do I do? I guess I have to put out a CD. So Ghost Light was the result of that. And considering it happened so unexpectedly and so quickly, I'm really thrilled with what happened.
Do you see certain common threads through the material that you wrote for this album, or is that something you leave to others to find in your work?
Well, I've learned that despite any intention I might have, what happens when a song or a story lands on the listener's ears is informed by their own experience, what happened to them that day, what they've been thinking about, what they've been reading, what other music they've been listening to. When I go back and look at these stories, a lot of them are about people dealing with change, whether it be, there's a song about an old farmer sitting in a bank and talking to his banker. And it's just a little snapshot, but it's pregnant with all kinds of metaphor for what's going on in a lot of places, especially rural America. I'm a product of rural America, and that is often the vehicle that I use, but it's not confined to things that are only happening there.
Studied and read, so tell me now, where do I sign? I spread out the papers, an ocean of white, and put his name to everyone. I seldom have seen a more heartbreaking sight as when he put down the pen, it is done.
You know, I'm 65 years old, and I've been writing songs for over 50 of those years, and I tend to sort of write from where I am. So whether it's about my little granddaughter at one discovering dancing while I'm playing the banjo for her, and just understanding this is a really special moment. She doesn't know what dancing is. No one has shamed her into thinking that what she's doing looks ridiculous. She's not trying to imitate somebody else dancing. She's just, this is a feral moment, and pay attention. And a lot of writing and a lot of these songs are about paying attention. Just, you know, look what's happening right here, right now.
So many artists are trying to respond to the issues of the present day right now, especially in this rather unusual era which we are right now in. Is there a challenge for an artist to be both timely and timeless in some way, especially in an era that is so fraught with all of these issues? Certainly, you mentioned Pete Seeger, and the timeless nature of his work stands out, yet he was also very much of his era. Is there a fine line to walk between responding to the immediacy of the moment and yet having a larger scope that might live beyond the present political situation?
Well, that's about as diplomatic phrasing as I've heard of this question. You know, the part of it is there's so much low-hanging fruit right now that it's really easy to be distracted. And you know, I have been guilty of saying, well, this little thing I heard about in the news today was so ridiculous, it'd be fun to write something funny about it. And humor is a great equalizer. It gets people who would probably disagree with one another on everything else laughing at the same thing if it's done skillfully. Humor has a very short shelf life. More directly to your question, I think often the most personal turns out to be paradoxically the most universal, and sometimes the most specific and timely ends up being surprisingly timeless. Probably the most topical song on Ghostlight is The Machine. It was the last thing on the album that was written. The album was essentially done. And then in the middle of August, the town that I lived in longer than any town I've lived in my life, Charlottesville, Virginia, raised my kids there, became front page news. And it was a horrifying day. And the days that followed were equally horrifying. And we tend to focus on a specific moment as though there were no moments that provide context for these things. And what I decided to do was look at it through the eyes of an old World War II veteran, someone who knew a thing or two about Nazis. This was a guy who was at Normandy. This was a guy who liberated one of the concentration camps. And seeing it through his eyes, you can, in 100 unspoken ways, sort of recalibrate the conversation. And that's part of what was so distressing about it. You know, you kind of think that regardless of who you vote for, what you think about healthcare, abortion, immigration, whatever, there's a few things that we agree on. And it would seem like Nazis and the Ku Klux Klan would be in that term.
I was on the beach that morning when half my company died. The history books now say it was the day that turned the tide. Back home our families all pitched in, save tires and tinfoil too. We realized that evil had a name that we all knew. Woody Guthrie had this guitar with the best sign I have seen. This machine kills fascists. We must be the machine.
And part of what art can do is hopefully redirect a conversation to say, hey, remember who we are. Remember who we are. And so that was the approach I took to that song. Plus, I just had to do something. It was my, you know, my hometown.
If you just joined us today on Valley Edition, we're talking to legendary folk musician and instrumentalist John McCutcheon performing Thursday at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Fresno. John, in recent years, you've had your own health scares and things like that. Has that given you a different perspective on things?
Oh, absolutely. Two ways, really, specifically. First of all, I'm fine now. But yeah, it's funny, I was telling my wife, I'm out here on the West Coast and I'm seeing a lot of old friends. And I was telling her that, you know, at our age, when you ask someone, how are you doing or how have you been, you better be prepared for a lot longer conversation than you expected. So for someone in their sixth decade to have some kind of a health hiccup and the first real serious one of their life, I count myself lucky that I got away with it for so long. But the two things were that I was apparently close enough to checking out, unbeknownst to me, that there was a lot of outpouring of support and love. And, you know, many of us, unless we get sick, don't get to hear that much. And so that was a real blessing. I got to stay home for 2 months, and I hadn't been home, you know, exclusively for 2 months in 40 years. I got to play with my grandkids every day. I got to finish Trolling for Dreams. Half the songs were uncompleted at the beginning of those 2 months, and I had lots of time to do that. But also, it really sparked a kind of empathy in me that I had never truly felt. There are people in this world who are sick. And it's as though when you're healthy that they live in another country. You're trotting territory that makes you completely unfamiliar with their burdens. And so I felt as though I had crossed some kind of boundary, and I was living in a world where people had to think about their health every single day. And I'd never had to do that. And I left part of me in that world. And I feel like a more whole person because of it.
Going back to Pete Seeger and songwriting itself, has your idea of what makes a great song changed at all over the years?
Oh, I think that my writing is a lot leaner now. I used to be horribly impressed with my ability to write beautiful poetry and real flowery stuff. And now I'm just interested in getting ideas across. But I still appreciate people who have great skills with the language. I find myself ending up being a lot more Woody Guthrie than Oscar Wilde. I am constantly moved by good pieces of music I hear. I mean, we're just at the tail, you know, we just came out of the holiday season, and The Messiah is on endless loop in my house for the holiday season, and I never tire of it. And I admire Handel, who wrote The Messiah in English, which was not even his language, and captured this massive, epic tale. And you know, my buddy Guy Clark died a few years ago, and I've been listening to a lot of his music and just thinking, wow, listening to him is like going to an honors class of how to write songs. And Pete was, you know, able to latch on to images and traditional themes and turn them into anthemic songs. If I had a hammer, where have all the flowers gone? Turn, turn, turn. I mean, most people don't have any idea he wrote those songs. And maybe that's the greatest thing. I mean, I grew up as a student of, and still am a student of, traditional folk music. These are songs that have to survive without the ability to be boosted by personality, by people, you know, this is a Bruce Springsteen song. This is a Pete Seeger song. This is a Holly Near song. It's all just because the song is good. And maybe Pete's greatest accomplishment is that people don't know that he wrote those songs, but they still are part of our canon of music.
Again, we're talking today with John McCutcheon, a legendary folk musician and instrumentalist performing in Fresno, ahead of the release of his 39th record, Ghost Light. I imagine we'll hear some selections from that. And it, again, is taking place in concert Thursday at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Fresno. John, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you so much for supporting live music in the Fresno area. It's a great service to your whole community.
Well, that's all for today's Valley Edition. For reporters Carrie Klein and Laura Tsutsui, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.